I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. This year, the number of Muslim Americans running for office hit unprecedented levels, and more minority voters, upset with Trump policies, are stepping off the sidelines and getting involved. Some are calling it a pivotal moment. Today, we sit down with two young Muslims living in the Kansas City area. They'll tell us how they're working to raise civic awareness in their communities. Then, the cinephiles are in the house again, this time to discuss film for children. We'll get tips about good screenwriting for kids and explore what makes a children's movie great. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Muslim Americans are among the least likeliest groups to vote. A local youth-led group is looking to change that and get more Muslims civically engaged. We'll now ask two leaders of the Muslim Civic Initiative what's motivating them and what they hope to achieve. This comes as more than 90 Muslims, mostly Democrats, entered races for public office on the local, state, and national levels this year. This is reportedly more than any other year since the September 11th attacks back in 2001. The two organizers of the nonpartisan Muslim Civic Initiative are Dania Hamuda. Dania, nice to have you. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Osama Etesham is also here. Osama, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, why are Muslims the least likely voter group to get out to the polls on Election Day? What's behind that, Dania?
So, I mean, there was a study conducted that indicated a few reasons why this could occur. But very simply, from what we've been observing, is that there's this general fear of politics. There's a stigma. And one of our visions as MCI is to break this fear of politics. That people, because Muslim Americans, not all are immigrants, but a big population are immigrants. And so there's this fear that comes from other countries. When they come here, they bring that fear with them. And so we just, want them to use their voices and promote democracy just as any other American would.
Is there a sense, Osama, that Muslims feel intimidated given the history, given 9/11? Which is that a factor in all this?
I do think it is. A lot of them, they have the feeling that if they stay out of like politics and getting engaged, like voicing their opinions, then people will just sort of like ignore them and they'll be able to get on with their day-to-day lives without having to worry about the racism, without having to worry about all the other problems. And we know that's not the case. Like, you can't escape the problems. So that's part of what we're doing, is trying to educate them about how to become engaged, why it's important to become civically engaged.
So this idea is if Muslims, some Muslims might feel that if they become active, they're just asking for trouble. Is that sort of, you're both nodding your heads.
Yes.
Is that, yeah. That's what you've sensed over the years?
Not all, but some. Yeah. But
is it mostly older Muslims?
Yes, I would say older and immigrants. Yeah. But they do pass it on to their kids at times, and their kids will stigmatize politics as a result.
You know, according to Pew, 70% of Muslims say they lean toward the Democratic Party, and half say the Republican Party is unfriendly to Muslim Americans. Do those numbers fit Kansas City from what you can tell? Does that ring true to you?
So based on the town hall that we had in Kansas, we had one Republican attendee, and I was the one filtering the questions, and I saw the questions, that there were some questions directed towards that person. Like, there was a little bit of animosity just because he's a Republican. Mm-hmm. Even though his views were not very inflammatory towards the Muslim community, there's just this association that Republicans are hateful towards Muslims just because of the rhetoric that's been tossed around in media.
Well, Osama, so in the wake of Donald Trump's election as president, is that energizing Muslims to get engaged in a way you haven't seen before and maybe breaking through this reticence that we talked about a couple minutes ago?
I do feel that, especially with the youth, that is the case. But again, like with a lot of immigrants and older people, they're sort of like shy away even more so, and they try to like...
Even more so,
just because like there's this fear, and like fear is like such a strong emotion, and so they're worried that with Trump, like if they voice their opinion on like any political issue, that can become even more dangerous. And they have like the use, I don't want to say like the white supremacy, but like you see like these like random cases of like incidents on like trains and buses and such. And that makes them like even more afraid. So,
how do you guys feel about this idea that some Muslims are afraid to speak out, or even afraid to vote?
I think it's a bit absurd because those are the same people who will complain about the result of policy decisions. Those are the same people who will be skeptical of politicians and the decisions made, and they have every right to be skeptical of the system because it is broken. However, I don't feel like they have a right to complain if they're not doing anything about it. And so that's kind of why we're trying to get people registered to vote, because you have no right to complain if you're the one who's letting this, you know, cycle, this vicious cycle, keep repeating itself.
And this is why you formed the Muslim Civic Initiative, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you hope that organization does, Daniel?
So very basically, we want to activate and empower. And that empower part of it is huge, because we want Muslims to, first and foremost, take ownership of their narrative. In this country, our story has been told for us. We don't get very many opportunities to tell our stories. So we're trying to pass on that message that if you don't tell your story, someone else will tell it for you, and it won't be pretty. And so that first and foremost, and second, using your story to empower you enough to put yourself in uncomfortable spaces, you know, to attend city council meetings, for example, to go to protests that are not predominantly Muslim attendees at the protests, you know, putting yourselves in spaces where we need to be present. We need to have a social and political presence.
Yeah.
And that's very simply what MCI seeks to promote.
You know, Osama, it's not lost on me that the two of you are both in your 20s. So we're seeing what appears to me to be a generational shift here pretty clearly.
Yeah, definitely. And I do feel like a lot of younger Muslims are taking more interest in politics and are not as afraid to voice their opinions. There does tend to be a bit of a difference with the older generation. They feel worried that the younger generation can be soft-spoken. They fear for them, so they'll tell them, hey, you shouldn't do that. And it's part of this... we face like a lot of like barriers, because especially like in the culture, to like correct an older person can be very
problematic. Yeah.
And so you have to like, while being respectful, you have to like tell them that this is the right thing to do. If we don't do this, we're basically letting our decisions being made for us. So,
And this is a piece of the narrative. There's also another piece where we did a voter registration drive actually this morning, and the responses we were hearing from people were very interesting. We were asking young people, like, are you registered to vote? And they were like, I don't want to vote. I don't think the system... They have skepticism of being able to change anything. They don't have hope that they're going to eventually make an impact with their vote or with their engagement.
But that feeling extends well beyond Muslims.
For sure.
To many of my students who are white and middle class. Right. I see that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is discouraging in and of itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other organization in Kansas City quite like the Muslim Civic Initiative? Are you guys, do you have the playing field to yourselves here?
So the reason we made MCI is because we felt like its vision was unique and the work wasn't being done. There are organizations that kind of touch upon this purpose. There's CARE, Kansas and Missouri. However, they're more focused on defending Muslims legally when they're discriminated against. So they're more reactive to situations. We're trying to be more proactive, educating youth, mobilizing, starting from the roots, the grassroots, and working our, you know, building power within the people.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to stay local. We're local and we want to remain local because we want to be unique to Kansas City and Kansas City issues.
And you're both sides of the state line though, right?
Yes.
How long ago did you form the organization, Osama?
So I actually joined about a year ago, but Danny, I believe, was one of the founding members about 2 years back.
Yeah, I would say the end of 2016 was when we began, when we got together and started talking about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Osama, why did you join? What brought you to the group?
So I actually found out about it through a friend of mine. And when I attended one of the meetings and the discussions that came up, like I found it very educational. We touched about a lot of viewpoints that I had thought of, but I hadn't seen different perspectives of them. And I felt that what they were doing was very unique, and I felt that my efforts would be well placed in this organization.
What kinds of programs, Dan, do you put on? Describe what the events are like.
Right. So very recently, we did two town halls, a Kansas and a Missouri one, basically brought people who were running for Congress and Senate and just had the Muslim community ask them questions and hold them accountable to them.
What kind of turnout do you get?
So for the Kansas one, we had over 100 people at that, Muslims and non-Muslims alike, but we had a large Muslim population at that event as well. The Missouri one wasn't as much. I would say 50 to 60 people attended that one.
Mm-hmm.
Our other events are centered around just issue-based public meetings where we incorporate civic literacy into those, but we also give people the outlet and the space to have meaningful, constructive dialogue about things they care about. So that's why we're really in tune with what Muslims care about in Kansas City, because we did a listening session campaign for almost a year where all we did was go to Islamic centers and mosques and just ask people, listen to them, what they're concerned about. And then that's how we kind of formulated the local elections campaign, where we're conducting the voter registration drives, the town halls, and the public meetings. So we have multiple tactics of reaching people.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about a new group, a relatively new group, the Nonpartisan Muslim Civic Initiative, empowering young people and trying to reach elders as well to get more engaged in politics. So how do your elders look upon the Muslim Civic Initiative? What kind of feedback have you gotten from parents, from others in the community?
So, I mean, there's a few different responses. One response is, of course, like, good job, you know, you're doing what we wish we did. And so we appreciate that. We think you're going to make an impact. That's one response. Another response is, good job, you know, you can tell they don't really think we're going to make an impact because they're skeptical of, you know, they're just cynical of everything. And then the third response is apathy or indifference or just, you know, okay, they brush us off sometimes, you know, when we're handing out flyers
right.
and things. So there's a few different responses, but we do go to our elders to seek advice, but we don't seek validation from them. So there's a difference. We don't seek advice. We don't seek validation. We seek advice and input. So we always ask after an event, you know, we ask anybody who attended the event, you know, what'd you think of it? And we like to hear criticism. We like to hear feedback because it really does shape what we do, but we don't let the negativity impact what we do.
Danielle, you realize you're the face of a new generation. This is a new way of thinking, and you're rocking the boat a little bit, right?
Right, yeah.
Which may be a really good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about where you're from and what your family background is. Osama, let me start with you.
So I was actually born in Saudi Arabia, but my parents are from Pakistan, and my mom was an American citizen before I was born, and so I came here when I was about 4 years old. I've lived here ever since. And so basically, like, my background is, like, I have, like, the Pakistani background, but having lived in America for pretty much my entire life, like, I dress American. I like to eat more so American food than for American culture to Pakistani culture. But I have developed an appreciation for Pakistani culture, I would say.
Yeah. As you approach people in Kansas City, how welcoming are they? Do you find people who are still a little bit reticent to embrace you and get to know you?
For the most part, I would say I've had very good interactions with people. They're usually very warm and welcoming, very nice. There have been a few negative interactions here and there, but few and far between, I'd say.
Yeah. Daniel, how about you? What's your own background, your family's background?
So I was born and raised here in Kansas City. I don't know anywhere else besides Kansas City, but my dad is Palestinian by heritage and my mom is Lebanese by heritage, but they both lived in Kuwait. So we were kind of raised on, I was raised with this idea that it's a privilege for us to be in this country. Mm. And my dad would always tell us, you guys are so lucky because you get to pick and choose what you like from both, like, all cultures and just, you know, become this, like he said, you guys have the open-mindedness of an American, but, you know, the family values of our culture. So he kind of, my dad and my parents, they value democracy and really, my parents are unique in that they push us to do these things because they know what it's like to be in a country where they are, you know, a disadvantaged
right.
in the minority group. Because in Kuwait, they were treated like outsiders. Because my dad is Palestinian and he doesn't have a Palestinian citizenship. And so it's a complicated situation with that.
Would either of you like to run for office one day?
I don't think I would have any plans of running for office now.
Yeah. But how about you, Daniel?
No.
Why not? You strike me as you'd be a terrific candidate.
I just am more of a grassroots, bottoms up type of person. I'd be very satisfied just teaching you know, in a high school for another 40, 50 years, you know. The most I want to move up is a school administration, but I really do believe that my impact as a teacher is greater than the impact of any politician.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, all this obviously comes as a time as Muslims are starting to stand out in national politics. As you guys know, two women made serious runs for Congress this year in a bid to become the first two Muslim women to serve in Congress. Do we know if they won their primaries?
Yes, both of them did actually end up winning their primaries.
Yeah. And there's two Muslim men serving in Congress now, Keith Ellison of Minnesota, Andre Carson of Indiana. But more than 90 Muslims, mostly Democrats, entered races for public office on the local, state, and national levels this year. That's the most since September 11th. What do you make of that?
I feel like it's a very good sign, a positive sign for the future. I feel like it shows that Muslims are realizing the importance of becoming civically and politically engaged. And so we are getting like more interaction with the Muslim community. And when that happens, I feel like it'll work to show the rest of Americans like, hey, like Muslims are just like you, you know, like we're normal people.
Mm-hmm.
We love living in America. We want to improve America as a country. So,
well, and it's not lost on me that this is the most since 9/11. So clearly Muslims feeling more comfortable engaging in a civic way than we've seen before. Mm-hmm. Those numbers are pretty clear here. You feel the same way, Daniel?
Yes. I think it's they're riding the energy of the revolution, because this is not only a Muslim-specific revolution. It's all over the United States of young people just being at the forefront of these movements. If you look at the Parkland shooting, who came out and protested? They were kids, you know? And so I just think that Muslims are riding this wave. And now more than ever, it's easy to be civically engaged just from your phone. You can be civically engaged via Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And so it's easier to be visible. It's easier to make your voice heard. So I think a lot of Muslims are taking advantage of that opportunity.
Now, here's some fun facts. Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. A lot of folks know that. The American Muslim population is expected to double by 2050. And if it does, it'll become the second largest religious group in the country. So we might only expect to see more Muslims running for office given the demographic shifts here.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, what issues are important to the two of you?
You want to go?
You can go.
Okay. For me, it's clearly education, number one. But not only educational reform, but also education as it relates to the prison system, because I really do think that there needs to be reform happening in that area as well. People don't know this, but schools and prisons are married with the school-to-prison pipeline. I saw this
What do you mean school-to-prison pipeline? Help me with that.
So the school-to-prison pipeline is basically the phenomenon of kids graduating high school with lots with, you know, a track record leading them directly to prison. And this happens because issues that are resolved in schools now are being the criminal justice system is more entangled in schools now. You know, issues that would be resolved by administrators are now being resolved by SRO officers, and they're writing actual tickets for the kids that stay on their record that set them up to graduate and go to prison. And there are also kids that are disproportionately graduating. Obviously, African Americans are more a victim to this, and Hispanics. And I saw this when I was teaching in an urban school. I saw how, you know, just the entanglement of the police in school issues. And so I think this is due to the for-profit prison system in our country, mm-hmm. and the privatization of the prison industry.
You want to change that, it sounds like.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And right now, actually, this is a relevant issue because recently, yesterday or the day before, prisoners came out and protested the inhumane conditions in prisons. And these inhumane conditions are occurring because of the for-profit system.
Yeah.
Because corporations are trying to cut costs, you know, and make money based off of the work of the prisoners by paying them very, very, very minuscule wages.
Well, Samuel, what's important to you issue-wise?
Issue-wise, I'd say like I'm very interested in healthcare, especially having like a biology background, and I'm being interested in medicine. I look and see like how there's like some people like in the Kansas City area alone who don't have access to healthcare. And we see, like, the Kansas City Free Clinic, they do a lot of work, but they're packed. A lot of people, like, will go into ERs and stuff, and then they'll be, like, set with a bill, and they can't afford to pay these bills.
Right.
And then there's also the case with medication, all that. So I'm very interested in trying to help provide healthcare to the general public quality, affordable healthcare. So
I'm wondering who you guys look up to, because it strikes me that there aren't a lot of political or civic role models in the American Muslim community. Who's an example you follow?
I'm not really a person that will choose someone and follow. You know, I'm not really looking for a role model. I like to, you know, create that. But
I'm getting that impression.
I'm not trying to be, but I don't encourage young Muslims to, you know, follow someone, be a follower. You know, I want them to create their own persona or their own identity. But I really admire the work of Dalia Mujahid. And she worked in the White House. She was in the White House administration, and she was the one who conducted the study that explained why Muslims were not voting. And so I admire her work. And who do you know?
How about you, Osama?
I tried to take things from different people. Recently, I've been very fascinated by, he's not an American, he's a Japanese scientist, but he did come to Stanford and he worked on his PhD. And a few years back, he came out with this revolutionary discovery of what he called induced pluripotent stem cells. And it's almost gets rid of the stem cell controversy. And there's so much potential to absolutely rid the world of disease. Mm. And I've been really fascinated by his work. Currently, it's a very expensive and long process. And he's trying to work on that because he's also of the belief that healthcare should be provided on a timely basis and affordable to everyone. And so
what's the next big event with the Muslim Civic Initiative, Danya?
So right now we're doing voter registration drives. One of them was today. Today was our religious holiday, Eid, and this is a time when lots of Muslims gather. So we took advantage of that and we're like, let's register people to vote. So and then there's also a National Muslim Voter Registration Day this Friday, which is, we're not the only city doing this. We got in touch with an organization called Empower, and they're doing this, get Muslim voter National Muslim Voter Registration Day,
right,
where we're doing drives in different areas. And there's also a prayer on Friday. So we're going to take advantage of Muslims gathering and just offer that service to the community.
That's Danya Hamuda. She is one of the founders of the Muslim Civic Initiative. We're joined by Osama Etesham. And I wish you both good luck, and keep us informed with what you're doing out there.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about iconic children's movies. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Monday's show, we checked in with The Mission Continues, the nonprofit founded by former Missouri Governor Eric Greitens before he took office. Hear how they're recovering from a tough year being associated with the governor's legal problems. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, a conversation about talking across the divide with someone who has spent decades building bridges between conservatives and progressives on matters of faith and public policy. You know, if there's a rule about writing a movie for children, it's this: don't write down to your audience. The cinephiles are in the house, and they're going to review a handful of iconic films for kids and what made them so iconic. Among the films we'll talk about today, E.T., Space Camp, and Jungle Book. The cinephiles are Mitch Bryan. He's a screenwriter and UMKC film professor. Mitch, always good to have you. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
Erin Hammerbeck is also here. She's a screenwriter who teaches at the Kansas City Art Institute and UMKC. Erin, always good to have you, too.
Thank you for having me back.
And that intro music you're hearing is the theme from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, right, Mitch?
Ouch, yes.
Yeah. Do you, too, buy the idea that, you know, some writers have espouse this notion that there's no such thing as a children's film or a kid's book? They're just good movies and bad movies, good books and badly written books. That makes sense?
I say yes. Erin?
I agree. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you agree, Steve?
Well, I'm looking to the experts here, but that's
I think so. I think about, as a parent, finding these kid-geared movies, right? And sometimes they're in the $1.99 bin at, you know, Target or something.
Right.
And you can really tell the bad ones from the good ones, you know? And the bad ones are maybe they're pacifiers for the kid for, you know, 30 minutes or something. I don't know how often the kid will go back to it. But the ones that really resonate are the things that we saw when we were kids that we can still revisit, the things that our kids see when they're kids, and they're still fond of them as they've gotten older.
Yes.
And it's, you know, that's where the real magic comes in.
Yeah. You know, it's been said, Aaron, that successful children's movies are movies that appeal to adults as well. That makes sense?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because there are several Disney movies that have come out recently. And I have a 2-year-old at home, and so she's kind of getting into these new films. And like Coco and Moana, and they are just about as good as they get. I mean, Coco is not only visually splendid, but it's also from a narrative perspective, it's gorgeous. It's got a beautiful soundtrack. And they're just really good movies. And so they're fun to watch.
And you find yourself sitting down with your daughter watching them all over again.
Every
right?
time. Yeah, yeah. I'm just as much into them as she is.
You know, Mitch, as a screenwriter, you may know this. Rule one, when it comes to writing a script for a so-called children's movie, don't write down to them. What does that mean exactly?
I think it means you have to consider that your audience may not know your story, but you got to give them the credit to be able to go with it and figure it out and engage with it. You know, mm-hmm. so you're making movies that are emotional, that have defined characters, that in the case of many children's movies have scary villains to drive the story ahead. Those are all things that we expect in any movie.
Aaron, is that a common mistake you see amongst your own students that when a kid approaches the idea of writing a children's movie, they're immediately writing down to them in some way?
You know, it's interesting because one of the first creative writing classes I ever took, the instructor said, if you're going to write a book or a short story about high school students, then they need to have stakes that are adult-sized. Nobody wants to read a book about high school students with high school problems. And so if you see, you know, some of these teen movies that are also family movies, they do have really high stakes. They're dealing with big problems. It's not just, you know, I can't get a date at prom or, you know, something like that.
So. Yeah, they go, like, what kinds of stakes? What do you see out there in terms of plot lines that grab people?
Well, like in E.T., for instance, in E.T., they're dealing with divorce. And I mean, I remember as a kid, I'd never really seen a movie that talked about that. And it kind of, you know, paved the way for other family movies like Mrs. Doubtfire that dealt with the really serious effects of families kind of breaking apart and how that affects kids. And I think that, you know, that kind of storyline is what really makes E.T. a classic and rewatchable.
That's interesting. Another tip I came across, Mitch, in writing a children's film, don't preach. Why not?
Because if the message isn't just built into the machine, the kids are going to smell it a mile away if you're trying to tell them what to do. That said,
you can't do that.
Well, yeah, but you know, Little Red Riding Hood, stay on the path. Don't talk to strangers. Mm-hmm. That's not too preachy, especially when the stranger happens to be, you know, a wolf dressed up, you know, like grandma. Right. And when you get off the path, you get into trouble. So I think that children's films, fairy tales, they do have these messages built into the narrative. They're teaching us how to live our lives and how to interact with other people and how to overcome obstacles, all of those things, and wish fulfillment. Being able to do better than the adult in the room is something that every kid wishes they could do or have more power than the adult in the room.
And lots of children's films emphasize that.
Sure.
Point.
Yeah, it's incredibly important, this idea of you know, wish fulfillment and empowerment. That goes into all great stories, but certainly all great kids' stories.
What about this notion, Aaron, of appropriately handling the villain in a kid's movie? Because I'm guessing here they can't be too scary. We all were raised with, you know, those memories of a movie that just scared you half to death as a kid, and The Wizard of Oz, which I guess even today I'm almost like, really? That got me that much? But it got me a lot when I was a little kid.
So which of the three things scared you the most? The monkeys, the witch, or the big head of Oz?
The witch.
The witch.
The witch, oh yeah. And the monkeys were sort of a second.
And I was always scared of the big head. I would run and hide when Oz would show up.
I was scared too exhausted the daylights by that out of point me. To be scared when the big head showed up. So how do you handle the villain thing?
Well, I mean, yeah, you definitely need to have a villain that is big and scary enough that it poses a real threat to the protagonist, you know, because they have to feel as though it's an insurmountable odd. So that's important. They can't just be, you know, an easy villain to take down, you know, where there are no high stakes. But it is that fine line of making them too scary. And
a lot of these things are really scary.
Really
the monkeys
scary.
And the big head and Wicked Witch of the, you know,
Or there are these villains that don't seem that scary. Like if you go back and watch the original Pete's Dragon, the villains in that movie are really despicable. I mean, they're talking about child abuse and they sing this like fun song about it's strange. It's awful. And it's one of those things that when you're a kid, you don't notice them as being these really terrifying creatures. But as an adult, it's kind of hard to digest watching it again.
Yeah.
But a lot of this conversation started because of the villain in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which is the kid snatcher who can smell children if they're hiding. He has this big old long nose.
Oh, wow.
Only shows up in the last half hour of the movie when the movie really needs something to raise the stakes, because there's nothing at stake in the movie up to that point. Mm. And he shows up and he has definitely terrified many a child. You go back and look at it now. I don't know if it's still scary or not.
But sounds really scary, at least the way you described it. I can't even remember the villain. So, yeah, it's been too long.
Yeah, it was pretty scary. So, you know, the hunters in Bambi are pretty scary. There are a lot of terrors that show up in these kid films because it's a scary world out there.
So you can go pretty far with making your villain scary, but you can't go there. I guess there is a too far, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is a line that I think, you know, you need to be careful of. I mean, the final villain in Moana is pretty scary, and I continue to be surprised that my daughter is, you know, doesn't run from the room crying, because it's a pretty scary villain, and you know, it's drawn scary, and it's, you know, but it's that fine line of making them scary enough that they're a good, you know, foil for the protagonist, but not too scary that we can't watch it.
You know, just for the record, Kathleen Pointer, who helps produce this program, is still freaked out by the Chitty villain. She still has nightmares to this day, just as you were describing.
Yeah.
So
I put on a really long nose and snuck into the office, and she screamed.
She screamed. Okay. Yeah. Well, let's turn to our films here. Mitch, you wanted to begin with Jungle Book. In case you've forgotten, this is about a tiger named Shere Khan forcing a man cub named Mowgli to flee the jungle and embark on a journey of self-discovery with the help of panther Bagheera and free-spirited bear Baloo.
Well done.
How's
that? Great. That was great.
Yeah,
this was the last movie that Walt Disney himself produced. He died before it came out. He took a very active hand in it because the previous movie, The Sword and the Stone, had not done well, although prior to that, 101 Dalmatians had been a big success. And it's a really fantastic movie still. It's beautiful to look at. The animation is extraordinary. The songs are great. And it has a very simple story, which is that Mowgli, who was raised by wolves and wants to stay in the jungle, can't, because Shere Khan, who hates men, is going to eat him. And by the time Shere Khan shows up, you're pretty convinced that Shere Khan's going to go through with it.
Yes.
Shere Khan's voiced by George Sanders, and he's deliciously, lugubriously evil. And then through this journey, Mowgli encounters all these different obstacles. There's a python that wants to eat him, and then there's King Louis, voiced by Louis Prima, the king of the orangutans, wants to learn how to make fire. So he's willing to tell Mowgli he can stay in the jungle if Mowgli will just teach him how to make fire. So everybody has an agenda. It's full of really great songs, and it's just still incredibly charming.
I can't help but wondering what you guys think of the newer live action version of The Jungle Book. Yeah.
I like it. And you know, it's weird because Christopher Walken voices the part of King Louis, and he kind of sounds like Louis Prima.
No, it's great, except the ending. Except the ending is so bizarre, because the beauty of The Jungle Book, spoiler folks, you know, is that Mowgli has to go to the man village. He can't live in the jungle because he's a man, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a bittersweet reality to it. And that line, and even in the Kipling text, I shall go to man, you know, as he leaves. And in the new Disney movie, he gets to stay in the jungle.
Oh,
yeah, you know, it's odd.
There's no penalty. There's no, it's like, it's just a sequel, I guess. They're ready for the jungle for the sequel to it or something. But it doesn't have that bittersweet reality. And that's also what great children's stories all have. It's like we're dealing with the real world. It may be unreal, but it's not untrue, to paraphrase Bruno Bettelheim.
We have a clip here from The Jungle Book. Mitch, what is it?
So this is King Louie striking a bargain with Mowgli about teaching him how to make fire.
Okay.
Have we got a deal?
Yes, sir. I'll do anything to stay in the jungle.
Well, then, I'll lay it on the line for you. Now, I'm the king of the swingers, the jungle VIP. I've reached the top and had to stop, and that's what's bothering me. I want to be a man cub, and stroll right into town, and be just like the other men. I'm tired of mugging around. Oh, ooby-doo, I want to be like you. I want to walk like you, talk like you, choo.
Well, if you haven't seen The Jungle Book for a while, go see it.
There you go. Right?
The original Jungle Book.
Yeah, 1967.
Yeah, okay. Let's turn to a different film here, Aaron. You want to talk about Moana from 2016. In ancient Polynesia, when a terrible curse incurred by the demigod Maui reaches Moana's island, she answers the ocean's call to seek out the demigod to set things right.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a classic magical realism of Disney. You know, it's steeped in, you know, the actual colonization of the Pacific Islands, where people, you know, had Stone Age technology, and they created these voyaging canoes and traveled thousands of miles through the ocean. But it also has all of these magical parts of it, you know, the Maui, the demigod, with his magical fish hook, he can change into different creatures, and the sort of reincarnation aspect. You know, Grandma passes away, but she's reincarnated as a. Oh, I can't think of the...
An ocean power,
and,
right?
Yeah, an ocean. Yeah, yeah. And it's just... And it's beautiful. And it's got the beautiful soundtrack. The once again, the animation is gorgeous. I think they had an entire team of animators that just worked on ocean animation. I mean, the water is just gorgeous.
And it's a great
movie.
Girl power movie.
It is. It's a fantastic girl power movie, in a way that not every princess movie in the Disney category of films can be. So.
How labor intensive is it to put out these animated films? I mean, it sounds like it would just be a lot, really hard.
It seems intense. And I've watched...
Particularly back in the day, right?
Oh, when you had to hand draw each cell. But I mean, we've watched a lot of the sort of making of Moana, and I mean, it's amazing the amount of work, the detail that goes into every single shot, and every voice of, you know, the character development. And it's incredible.
Yeah. Didn't the star of Hamilton write some of this music?
Yeah, Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote a lot of the music. Actually, he started working on Moana before he started working on Hamilton.
Oh, is that
so
right?
He spent more time working on and developing the music for this, and it's gorgeous. It is just an amazing soundtrack, so beautiful.
What's the clip we have here from Moana?
So this is Moana is facing. She has to face different obstacles to, you know, finally win the day, and this is one of her obstacles. She faces a giant crab called Tamatoa, that's voiced by Jemaine Clement, and this is her first time encountering him.
What have we here? It's a sparkly, shiny... Wait a minute. Oh, it's a human. What are you doing down here in the realm of the month?
Just pick an eye, babe. I can't concentrate on what I'm saying if you keep...
Yeah, pick one. You're a funny-looking little thing, aren't you?
Don't! That's my grandma's!
That's my grandma's! I ate my grandma, and it took a week, because she was absolutely humongous. Why are you here?
Because you're amazing! And we mortals have heard of the tale of the crab, who became a legend. And I just had to know how you became so crab-uless.
Are you just trying to get me to talk about myself? Because if you are, I will gladly do so.
Huh?
In song form.
That's from Moana. If you're just joining us, so you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about some iconic children's films that you maybe haven't looked at for a while that perhaps is deserving of your attention. We're visiting with the cinephiles there, Mitch Bryant and Aaron Hammerbeck. Mitch, let's turn to another one that I think almost everyone in the universe has seen at least four times, and that's E.T. Tell us about it. I think everyone knows the plot already.
You know, Steve, I've only seen it twice.
Oh, get out of here.
Yeah. When it came out...
I would have you for a 17 or something.
The summer that it came out was the summer of The Thing, and I loved The Thing, and The Thing was a bad alien movie. And then E.T. comes out. The Thing is a huge bomb. E.T. becomes the biggest grossing movie of all time, you know? And I had a bad attitude. I was a 21-year-old with a bad attitude. And so I kind of just dismissed it.
I can see that in you, by the way.
Yeah. So... I went back to watch it again because obviously it's a great movie and everybody agrees it is. So I got to sort of see it again. And it really is an extraordinary movie. I mean, Spielberg is at the top of his game as a director. His form,
is this his greatest film or my
It's one of them. It's certainly his. I'll watch Jaws always before anything else by him. So and I like Close Encounters as well. But it's fascinating because the first 10 minutes of the movie, there's no dialogue. It's really told visually and it's kind of scary. It's because we kind of see E.T. get left behind and stranded. And there are these big humans coming after him, big, huge, faceless humans with one guy has jangling keys on his belt. And it has this really intense vibe at the beginning. It feels like a horror movie almost. And then we meet, you know, Elliot, and you know, he's having a tough time because as Aaron had said, there's a divorce. He's dealing with that. He's got a big brother that kind of pushes him around and a little sister that seems to be getting more attention than him. And so he has this relationship. He discovers E.T. and they form this relationship that becomes almost a psychic bond. Mm-hmm. There's a famous scene where E.T. manages to get a hold of some beer and drink it, and Elliot feels drunk while he's at school. And so there's this magical aspect to it as well. It's a fantastic movie. I'm stating the obvious, but it's also really interesting because the villains that seem to drive the movie transform into something else by the time you get to the end. And that's another thing that makes the movie so dynamic is that personalities are shifting and things are changing all the way through.
So for Spielberg, this was his fourth film?
No, I think it was one, two, three, fifth or sixth.
Because
he'd done Raiders before that.
Raiders.
And 1941, Close Encounters, Jaws, Sugarland Express, Duel. So it was six or seven. So he was definitely at the top of his game.
Why has he gotten away from these kinds of films? I mean, why can't you recreate great songs like the Beatles do all the time? But he's gone somewhere else in his career.
Yeah, but by the same token, he's still fascinated with this idea of, you know, a boy alone trying to find his way in the world or find his way home. Certainly Ready Player One was dealing with that. Empire of the Sun, which is underrated, I think, deals with this idea of the boy alone. I mean, it does seem to be this thing that he returns to over and over again.
What's the clip we have from E.T.?
So this is probably the most famous moment in the movie because, as I said, things are always changing. And in this particular case, we find out that E.T. can actually talk and utters the famous line that everybody remembers from the movie.
Phone home.
There you go.
E.T. Home phone.
E.T. phone home.
E.T. phone home.
E.T. phone home.
He wants to call somebody.
What's all this?
E.T. phone home.
Oh my God, he's talking.
E.T. phone home.
E.T. phone home.
And they'll come.
Come home. Home.
E. E.T., would you just phone home?
Yeah, get it over with.
get going. Okay, Aaron, let's turn to the final film of the day. This is 1986's Space Camp. This is about the young attendees of a space camp. They find themselves in space for real when their shuttle is accidentally launched into orbit.
So this is a personal favorite of mine. This would have been something, you know, I loved science fiction films when I was a kid. And it came out at the same time when, you know, science fiction films were so popular. I mean, you know, Star Wars, Star Trek, Joaquin Phoenix is in Space Camp, and I think he's 12.
Oh, is that right?
He is so adorable. He's he's got this very squeaky voice because he's like getting into adolescence, and it's so funny to see him in this movie because he's just a little kid, and he's constantly making these references to Star Wars, and because I mean it was such a popular time for science fiction. You know, we had the Flight of the Navigator and the last Starfighter, and kids just loved watching science fiction.
Yeah. And this film, what else appeals to you about it? I mean, this notion of being in space for real is kind of, you could sort of relate to that, I guess.
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid, that's what I wanted to be. If you would ask me, what do you want to be when you grow up? Astronaut. That's the only thing I ever said. And I mean, it was a great movie because it showed girls as astronauts. Kate Capshaw is, you know, she's kind of the head of the space camp program for this group of misfits, and it stars Leah Thompson and Kelly Preston, and you know the entire story of the Space Camp is motivated by girls, and so I really could directly relate to it. Yeah.
What's the clip we have here from Space Camp?
So this is a moment where they have just failed a simulation. They failed it in many different ways. The space commander of the shuttle has failed in you know, leading his team. It's just kind of all fallen apart.
I don't want to hear about it. I can't hear it. You know why? Because you're all dead. You just disintegrated during re-entry. Huh? Don't you understand what that means? You're all dead because you didn't work together as a team. And you're responsible.
Me?
That's right, you. You're shuttle commander. That means you are responsible for everything that happens on this ship.
I didn't ask to be responsible, remember?
That's a pitiful excuse for killing four people.
Oh, God, I don't believe this. Look, nobody got killed, okay? I mean, it's just space camp.
Didn't the Challenger thing happen right before this, and this film, as a result, didn't do all that well?
That's kind of the antagonist of the film. The Challenger accident that happened in January of 1986, and it delayed the release of the film by 5 months. And it basically just destroyed the film because it's not only about the shuttle program, but the incident that brings the group up into space in Space Camp is a malfunction of the solid rocket boosters, which is exactly what happened at Challenger.
Bad timing.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation. There's some good, iconic kids' films to go back and check out. I want to thank Aaron Hammerbeck, a screenwriter who teaches at the Kansas City Art Institute and UMKC. Mitch Bryan, a screenwriter and UMKC film prof. Thank you both very much.
See you next time.
Good conversation, Tomorrow on the show, local reaction to the latest wave of revelations about sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.